uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there in cyberspace. Close your eyes, and when I say the word hacker, what is the first image that pops into your mind? For me, it's always going to be Serial, Matthew Lillard's character from the movie Hackers. Weird hair, a little too focused, driven by an ideological need for information to be free, copies of 2600 magazines scattered around his coffee table, and always one step away from being busted by the feds. That image is, and always was, a fantasy. What hackers are and what they've become is complicated. The world has changed. And what was once synonymous with criminal has become, through years of activism and hard work, something different. Hacker means so much more than it used to. And the story of that change and how hackers went from criminals to security experts and respected, if not always trusted, members of society is the subject of the excellent study, Wearing Many Hats, The Rise of the Professional Security Hacker. The authors are here with us today to give us that brief history of hackers, especially focusing on that wonderful period in the 90s, the golden age, as they call it. The first is Harvard anthropology professor Gabriella Coleman, and we also have data and society researcher Matt Gertzen. I'm Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. So thank you both so much for coming onto the show to talk with us about all this.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so first, let's. I like to do very basic stuff at the very top. Can you give us kind of the early etymology of the word hacker?
Biela?
Sure. The early etymology came from MIT, a university in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And it was a term that members of the Tech Model Railroad Club would use to designate those technologists in the club who are willing to kind of experiment with the railway and do things differently. Another adjoining kind of meaning of the term hack was also a prank at MIT. And the MIT students were quite famous for doing kind of various pranks, especially one big one a year. Where they might, for example, put a fire truck, a real fire truck, on top of the MIT dome. But eventually, the term at MIT and elsewhere came to be used for a kind of obsessive computer enthusiast who could, you know, do amazing and beautiful things with computers.
Okay, so the associations kind of at the start were not immediately criminal, right? It was kind of like somebody who was good at this, like a prankster. There's always kind of a little bit of element of chaos to the thing. When does it kind of become something a little bit more dangerous?
Well, I can field that one, I guess. It seems like that shift kind of happens in the late 1970s or early 1980s, where you know, some figures who identified with the term hacker, maybe in a more old school MIT kind of way, became interested in security, but more specifically, when the media started using the term hacker to label people who were interested in gaining unauthorized access to systems on the early internet. So actually, a lot of hackers in the MIT or in the MIT sense kind of rejected that labeling and called for those people to be called crackers rather than hackers to connote the way that they were interested in cracking into systems or cracking passwords.
See, I always took cracker to mean, and like my background, I guess I was raised in Silicon Prairie, North Texas. As a teenager in the 90s, and I always kind of made the distinction between hacker and crackers. Like, hacker is someone who is kind of actively seeking to enter systems and commit some sort of mischief or crime. And a cracker was somebody who was purely interested in the pleasure of breaking into the thing for the sake of it. But there's something a little bit more pure to the cracker. There was like somebody that was solving a puzzle. Right. Am I just having a misconception, or is there any truth to that?
Well, I think what you point to is that these terms were floating, and in part, the definition of cracker that Matt was referring to came from the hacker jargon file, and Eric Raymond in specific, who came from the more MIT tradition and was trying to differentiate, you know, let's just call them builders from breakers, right? And the term cracker and the term hacker, in spite of certain places where there is origins or definitions, take on their own lives, right? Where people have a different kind of meaning in their head. I mean, for example, for some people, a cracker is someone who cracked games or software so that you can sort of access them as well. And so there's always kind of multiple meanings and polyvalence that comes with these terms, which was one of the tough things about writing this report. We had to be very clear how we were using the terms, how they were found historically, and then how they were contested in the community as well.
Can you get into, I think this is there's a lot of fascinating things about this study, but one of the things I think was really interesting was how this was all conducted, like how you guys gathered the information, where you found it, who you talked to. Can you kind of talk about how you build this history out of something that has, like, some of it's sitting on all these old BBS databases, right? Like, how do you track this stuff down and pin it all down?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of had like a mixed methods approach to the study. So the real, like, I guess, like, backbone of our research was a series of, I think, around 30 interviews, like typically quite long, 3-hour, sometimes longer interviews with some people who are core figures in this kind of shift from, rogue underground hacker to security, paid security researcher. But then we supplemented that with, a copious amount of archival data. And one of the nice things about this subject matter is that, hackers, whether we're talking about the, unauthorized access type of hackers or the, MIT type of hackers, they tend to be pretty diligent self-archivists. So there's a lot of material that remains available online, and, a lot of mailing lists that where a lot of the conversations that we talk about can be, can be seen in their entirety. There are, it's kind of interesting, though, because as we were going through and doing this research, like 1 year to the next, some of the references we would have saved, you'd click on the link and it would be gone. So, we also owed a huge debt to the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine project, which, has kept a lot of the personal web pages of some of these hacker figures alive. The Usenet archives seem to be harder and harder to find, and some things like that. But there's a lot of archives out there, so we kind of triangulated between the interviews and the archival material that we were able to get a hold of.
Yeah, maybe I'll say one more thing about it. I mean, I call this like living histories of the internet. It's historical material, but you could really juxtapose the archive with interviews. And that really helps for, verifying some facts. Some were really, really, really hard to do so. Another thing that was great were talks from DEF CON, from HOPE. We watched them, we listened to them. And that was also really incredible material, very rich material for this.
Yeah, I'll point out for people that are listening to this later and not watching it live that you are wearing a DEF CON shirt as we sit here and talk, which I thought was very, very appropriate.
That's right. Form and function.
So, yeah. So at the early outset of this phenomenon, hacking, these are really intelligent people that are playing around with new systems. When does it first kind of become what is considered a criminal act? What precipitates that, and when do laws start getting passed?
I mean, even prior to the passing of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which I think was passed in 1986, though there were some precursor laws, but as a standalone, it was CFAA in 1986. That really, I think, cemented the time and period where there was massive concern around criminality and hacking, and the movie War Games, particularly important for that history. I believe it was played for Ronald Reagan, and there was a kind of a lot of hysteria that was built up around that. But prior to that period, there were certainly many news stories that concerned, you know, criminal or intrusive hacking. Sometimes it was non-malicious. Sometimes it was malicious. And certainly even before the rise of hacking, there was phone phreaking. The phone freaks were kind of the precursors to the security hackers because they explored systems. They were concerned with security, with often fixing the phone system. And the FBI also went after some of these phone freaks as well. So, you know, there's like the longer history and then the more immediate history where in the mid-1980s, there was, I would say, like the real consolidation, both because the law matched, the law kind of cemented the sort of paranoia that exploded at the time around hackers.
Yeah, I think it's the amount of times that government policy at the federal level changed because Ronald Reagan watched a movie is pretty fascinating. One of my favorites is always that they showed him the day after and he decided to pursue nuclear drawdown with Russia. And he wrote about it in his diary. That's like, you can go look it up. Just fascinating. But, you know, back to hacking. Speaking of War Games, playing in our intro there, I heard both of you kind of giggle when you heard it. So around also this time, what I would call like hacking culture develops, right? Can we talk about like the development of that and like what that entails? I think you kind of put it in, starts to kind of grow in the 1980s when this underground begins. Was that a direct consequence of the laws, do you think, or was there more going on there?
I mean, my sense is that a lot of the small groups that first formed in the 80s, and then there was also many groups in the 90s, they formed independent of the laws. And it was in part just because people found each other on things like first BBSs and then internet relay chat, right? Prior to that, the phone freaks found each other as well and would get together on party lines. And there were also kind of local BBSs for phone freaks. So there was always, you know, independent of what was going on in the legal sphere, just plenty of opportunities for hackers to get together, to associate. They had named crews. You know, many of them also published different zines or followed, you know, the Uber zine Frack, which was particularly important for the security community. And I just think the kind of legal ramifications and threats just gave the community a kind of heightened sense of itself, right? Because there was kind of always that threat. But interestingly enough, I mean, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not sure if we like actually wrote about this in the report. If we did, it was maybe in passing. I mean, many of the 1990s crews, even though there were some big busts in the late 80s, weren't as threatened by the law. And they weren't as concerned with, you know, the FBI kind of knocking on their door, which I found very interesting and kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah. Can you talk about that, Matt?
Yeah. I mean, I think like just to add to what Biela said, I think like the role of this kind of, you know, the passing of the laws and kind of like the, you know, the hacker crackdown, as Bruce Sterling's called it. I think it also helped to contribute to the creation of a hacker culture and a hacker scene by giving folks like a sense of like a foil or like an other against which they were defined, you know, so they were able to, see themselves as different and under attack and kind of come together that way. But yeah, I think a lot of the people we take as our subjects in the report certainly didn't have the same kind of legal, immediate legal risks that a lot of the hackers in the late 80s and early 90s experienced. And in fact, some of the phenomena that we talk about, like the full disclosure movement hosted on, you know, as we talk about it in relation to the mailing list bug track, which was started by a member of the Legion of Doom, you know, shortly after they, among other early hacker groups, had had been, you know, targeted by law enforcement. So you could in some ways see the some of the cultural developments we're talking about as like a direct attempt to find a way to engage with these kind of security puzzles and things that these people enjoyed so much in a less antagonistic but less legally, you know, problematic way.
And I have two questions here before we kind of move on a little bit, and I definitely want to get into the full disclosure movement because I think that's pretty core to kind of what you're talking about. But first, can we talk a little bit about, were there ideological underpinnings here? Like, what was the thought movement of these early hacker groups? Like, what did they believe? Because again, Silicon Prairie, growing up reading cyberpunk novels, the line was always information wants to be free, right? And should be freely accessed by everybody. Was that true? Was that just like a line? What, you know, what's going on there? What's the ontology of the hacker space?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's a great question and complicated one to answer insofar as, you know, among some of the groups that we were looking at, certainly there was a sort of anti-authoritarian bent, right? There was also a kind of commitment to getting knowledge out there. And a little bit later, we'll talk about that in relation to full disclosure. Certainly, some of these groups also left the shadows. They had a very, very strong kind of commitment to sort of advocacy around security, and that's a certain type of politics. But among the groups that we were looking at, in other aspects, they were remarkably apolitical at some other level, with a few exceptions. The Cult of the Dead Cow, which popularized the term hacktivism, certainly had their foot in politics around human rights and technology. But many of the kind of security-focused groups and individuals were immersed in computer networks and breaking into them and learning about them initially for kind of intellectual edification, right? And again, there was a kind of anti-authoritarian bent, and many of the materials that were being published that they were reading. But the groups themselves seem to be more concerned about their own intellectual autonomy, and then eventually kind of transitioned to kind of security advocacy. And one, you know, there's 2600, which is a very important zine, which was committed and is committed to making hacker politics and technology more accessible. And some of the groups that we looked at and the individuals that we interviewed, you know, tended to be very familiar with 2600. They were maybe participants in the monthly meetings, but over time tended to stray away from there precisely because it wasn't kind of technical enough compared to their interests. But there were other currents that were very political at the time and that, you know, consolidated even more later. They just tended not to be the focus of this particular study.
Another thing you guys have this kind of aside about that I think is really interesting and really important, and also something I hadn't considered, never really read about in this space: who gets to be a hacker? Who gets to participate in these early days? What are, say, the material conditions that allow for a hacker and to kind of rise up through the ranks? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, there were a number, you know, by the early 1990s, kind of a number of different venues had popped up where hacker sociality could occur, where people could come together. So there was the, you know, in the earliest form, there was the, you know, BBSs, where people could dial into other computers and leave messages for one another and share files and so on. And at that time, it seems like, you know, the criteria of entry was basically like knowing that something exists and, you know, having the wherewithal to answer questions in a certain way to gain access to some of the more private systems. But as time went on, of course, I think like as things became more materialized, partially from like you know, the emergence of 2600 meetups, regional meetups, and so on, you know, took on like a more of a classic social dimension where people would come to things and you would be welcomed or not based on various criteria, not only interest or the ability to show up. So we talked to some, you know, female hackers who at that time felt very excluded because they weren't the kind of default subject position. And also at, you know, conferences, also material, but also in the 1990s, like IRC, Internet Relay Chat, really became, I think, in many ways, the core of like the day-to-day hacker scene. And again, there was like, even though people could show up with you know, pseudonyms or whatever, there was a you know, there was a certain type of culture in place, and certain people felt excluded just by the mode of discourse and so on. And towards the end of the 1990s, you know, a lot of these IRC channels became increasingly like prone to like gatekeeping, and people would be like quizzed on you know, technical know-how in order to not be kicked out of certain channels or things like that. So yeah, I think like as time went on, the scene became more and more kind of like technocratic in a way. And less like about just like a shared interest in a certain culture or relationship to technology.
Yeah, at a certain point, it becomes about keeping the culture going for the culture's sake, and not necessarily the curiosity and interest in technology that brought everybody there in the first place, right? As it begins to like put down roots, I guess, and grow. Let's switch tracks here and then talk about how the community changes, right? In the 90s, there's like this concerted effort to reform the image of the hacker. What is the full disclosure movement?
So, I mean, I guess I can take that on. So it's unclear to us when exactly the term full disclosure started being used, but certainly by like early 1990s, it was pretty commonly, you know, pretty commonly used to describe basically a relationship to information about security vulnerabilities, where the person who possessed the information would disclose it publicly. I mean, often in, you know, very selective channels. So it was public, but like it disclosed in places where not that many people were positioned to see it necessarily, you know, so like pretty niche mailing lists and Usenet groups and so on. But fundamentally, it was based on the idea that all information about computer security and computer security vulnerabilities, and or vulnerabilities in particular, software or hardware, should be in the public domain, both to put pressure on companies to close off those vulnerabilities, and also to enable education, and also so that, you know, early systems administrators might be able to know about that information and make changes to their own networks, maybe by disabling certain software so their users weren't threatened by the vulnerability in question. So sorry, that was a kind of a rambling response that didn't necessarily get at everything that's important to say. But another thing that's really crucial to note is full disclosure was in many ways a reaction to the dominant attitude towards computer security issues at the time, which was kind of represented by an organization called CERT, which came about in the late 1980s, largely as a response to the internet worm created by a student named Robert Tappan Morris Jr. And the attitude of CERT was that computer security vulnerabilities should be kept private and shared among the affected parties, so among the software vendors and institutions that were most affected by them. And so a lot of the early proponents of full disclosure were basically directly reacting to that, like ethos. And yeah, I don't know. What have I missed here, Riel?
Sorry, go ahead.
Nothing. I mean, just one last thing. It was wildly controversial at the time, you know, and that was partly why it was effective, and it put hackers on the map. Just at the moment, you know, they were sort of had already a sort of pretty bad public image. So as they were putting full disclosure out there and making kind of technical arguments around why it was a valid method, they were also doing a kind of media reform as well at the very same time.
This is kind of like an early battle in the walled garden versus open source philosophy, right? And this is kind of hackers kind of starting to come to the fore and pick sides in this argument. Can you tell us about, you know, we mentioned it a little bit earlier, can you tell us about BugTrack and why it's important to what goes on here?
Yeah, so BugTrack was created in 1993 by a few hackers who were members of the Legion of Doom, LOD, which was one of the most infamous, you know, notorious early, you know, hacker crews that was, you know, widely discussed in the media and was subject to a lot of FBI or law enforcement attention, Secret Service. So shortly after this kind of criminal law enforcement interest, I messed up. BugTrack was created by a single member of the Legion of Doom,
right,
named Scott Chasen.
Right.
But a couple years prior to that, three members of the Legion of Doom had created CompSec, a security early security services company. It was the first time any hackers had kind of switched over to the vendor side and tried to create a security company. And it was met with a tremendous amount of skepticism, both from the hacker community and also from the computer security, the nascent kind of computer security institution and establishment. The hacker community saw these, there's so much context that is relevant here. It's hard to know what to focus on exactly.
Did I give you too big a
question? Basically, well, the Legion of Doom at that time was engaged in a huge dispute with another hacker crew called the Masters of Deception, mm-hmm. MOD. And so CompSec, the creation of CompSec for some hackers was seen as a way for the LOD hackers to like gain like insider information through like the clients that they were working with. So basically being able to operate in early cyber infrastructure with certain privileges that were not available to other hacker crews. And then of course the computer security establishment was skeptical of CompSec because they were hackers and they thought maybe they were doing exactly that same thing as well. You know,
it's the arsonist or the firefighter, right?
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the metaphors that, or, you know, there's a style, a class of metaphor that repeats throughout our report, which is, you know, the question of whether professionalizing hackers are, you know, whether it's advisable to hire a former arsonist to be a fire marshal. You know, just because they know how to set fires doesn't mean that they are the best person to protect you from fires and so on. So there's, you know, versions of that metaphor repeat on into the early 2000s and probably today as well. So after CompSec folds due to this scrutiny, one of the LOD members who had started CompSec, Scott Chasen, he Wait, was it Scott Chasen or was it Chris Goggins? Now it's Scott Chasen. I'm mixed up. Yeah. It was Scott Chasen. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, full disclosure, I got only like 2 hours of sleep last night. I'm having almost a psychedelic experience right now, but
we'll get there. I've got the article in front of me right here. Shortly after the failure of ComSec in 1993, Scott Chasen founded the BugTrack mailing list.
Right. Yeah, you can fact check me in real time using the material
Can I jump in for a moment,
based on what you said?
Sure. Just because, I mean, obviously BugTrack was important because people share the technical information around full disclosure and drop vulnerabilities, sometimes even exploits. But one of the key sociological changes that it helped create is that different communities that were not in conversation with each other, the hackers, a system administrator, some academics, others who are just like interested in security and came on board, old school, more Unix-y hackers in the MIT tradition, came together to talk about security. And this was important for many reasons, but I'll just highlight two very quickly. One, which is there was a kind of creation of an independent group of people interested in security. And so while we focus in mostly on hackers, like this whole group, I think, was important in shedding or putting kind of critical pressure on the vendors later. And then the other thing is, even as there was kind of media, cultural, and linguistic work that some hackers, and especially the group The Loft did, to kind of renovate their image, just having these hackers who were formerly part of pretty secretive associations, right, be able to converse publicly with others who were not hackers, I think helped to rehabilitate their image, right? There was actually a sociological relationship. And Matt, you know, wrote the section on full disclosure and very nicely, you know, came up with the phrase that this was like drawing on an academic, Peter Galison, this was a trading zone, right? Yeah. Where differently positioned groups come together. And that was so central to, again, at least having a group of people go, you know, these hackers, they know something and they're not so like scary.
Yeah, I'm just going to read a little bit from the welcome message from the board from 1993. What is this list about? This list is for detailed discussion of Unix security holes, what they are, how to exploit, and what to do to fix them. This list is not intended to be about cracking systems or exploiting their vulnerabilities. It is about defining, recognizing, and preventing use of security holes and risks. Everything submitted to the list is archived, is available to the public. Simply send a message to bugtrack/request@crimelab.com with the subject archive.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The other thing that I think is really interesting that's happening around this time sociologically is that helps reform images is, and these are the thing, these are the stories that I grew up on, is hacker gets busted, does time, gets out, gets hired by whoever they were hacking. Can you talk about why that is, like, how that is part of this, and what that does to the image of the hacker? And who was the first one? Do you know that? I may be asking a question that's not easy at hand.
Do you want to go ahead, Bill?
No. Why don't you jump in? I mean, I have some thoughts about this, and I'm also trying to think of the first one, though I don't think I have that.
I think like there's two things that are interesting to touch on in relation to that question. So like in our report, we mostly focus on hackers that were, you know, publicly doing work to reform the perception of hackers. And so I think like the creation of BugTrack by Chasen was so influential because, you know, this was a public site where these former hackers or these current hackers who were trying to identify as having a certain disposition were, you know, engaging with other people in real time. You could, you know, anyone could show up to the, you know, or, you know, look at the archives of the list and see the tenor of the conversation and so on. But there were also at this same time hackers that were getting out of jail or whatever and starting to work for companies. So I think one of the earliest ones, if not the first one, was Fiber Optic, Mark Abini, who was a member of MOD, the rival group of the Legion of Doom. And I'm not sure what year he got out of jail, but he went to work for a company pretty early on. But often these hackers that had criminal records, when they were employed, the companies did not advertise the fact that they were employing these people. You know, like they didn't feel like the hackers had, you know, refurbished their reputation sufficiently that they could do that and maintain the trust of their clients. So you actually also had at this time a lot of companies talking about how they were hiring hackers, but they weren't using them in any client facing work because they wanted the clients to feel like they could trust that these hackers weren't going to get into their, you know, back end and do something fishy or whatever.
Did you have something to add, Gabriel?
I mean, two things. One is, I mean, that's precisely right. And one of the things we do in the report is try to locate that moment in the late 90s, early 2000s, when finally some companies, and AtStake being the most famous one, who kind of acquired The Loft, you know, very proudly advertised that there were gray hat hackers working for them. And this was really a watershed moment because, again, these companies were hiring them, but quite quietly, you know, and there was always this risk. And we have some great quotes in our report where, you know, some of these hired hackers were sort of told, you know, you better not go to DEF CON, or you better, if you go, like, no pictures, we don't want to see any pictures of you, right? And so there was definitely this turning point in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it was a turning point, but the specter of the term hacker and the threats against hackers and also security researcher never went away, right? It just had been more acceptable. And then, you know, the threat would kind of come and go after 2000. But certainly before that period, it was really just something was very hush-hush.
Well, and it's funny, too, because obviously these companies needed the hackers, right? It seems like they were the only people that were doing this kind of work at the time, right? And they had to bring them on. So it's just interesting to watch that happen.
I mean, that remains a source of contention, I think, in the computer security industry, whether they needed the hackers or not, right? Because there was one, you know, full disclosure was also kind of, you know, like the flip side of full disclosure was like an approach to security that is often called security by obscurity, right? Where the idea is that systems will be more secure even if systems do have vulnerabilities, they will be more secure in practice if those vulnerabilities are not known, because less people will have the information they need to exploit them. So obviously hackers push back on that philosophy for a number of reasons. And, you know, we detail some of those in the report. But, you know, after the period we cover in this report, there was actually a pretty sizable backlash within the computer security community to the arrival of these professionalized hackers. Because a lot of people saw them as basically selling the cure to the disease that they themselves had unleashed, you know.
They're the firemen coming to put out the fire after they've set it, right?
Exactly. So for a lot of people in that industry would prefer that these hackers had just gone away completely. They didn't think their skills were needed. They didn't think the attention that they were drawing to these issues were helpful. And the alternative perspective was was, you know, coming from systems administrators who were upset that they weren't hearing about these vulnerabilities from CERT, and so they couldn't take steps to fix the issue because they didn't know they existed, right? So these two things were kind of playing off each other and continue to some extent to this day, you know?
You know, there's very briefly one of the great stories. It's not in our report, but it's something I've worked on and did a short BBC podcast on. And in France, in the late 1990s, two intelligence organizations took very different approaches to computer hacking. One decided to recruit arrested hackers because they didn't know how to hack, right? They didn't know how to hack. Let's go to these youthful guys. And they did help. They were recruited either to do military service or meet with them once a month. A competing intelligence organization was like, are you nuts, you know, enrolling these like petty criminals? And then they just retrained their cryptographers to hack. You know, personally, I do think these hackers had tremendous, tremendous skills and knowledge that was really important that they acquired through these many years in this decade of exploration, right? But nevertheless, probably, you know, there could have been other sources of security expertise. But nevertheless, I think both their skills and their adversarial style were really important because, you know what? Microsoft did not want to change.
Yeah.
You know, they had to be pushed. And you know what? Professors are not going to do that. That sort of pushing. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, I think the greatest like testament to the fact that these hackers did truly have skills we talked to a former NSA hacker who said that in the late 90s they were reading FRAC and sometimes getting novel information out of it. So it wasn't even that that there was like, you know, these intelligence, like secret hacker technologists working for the government that always knew all of the same stuff. There was real knowledge being generated by the hackers, you know, according to anecdotes like that.
Let's talk about then using that as a segue. What is Loft Heavy Industries and why is it important to this story? What does it do that nobody else did?
So yeah, Loft takes a central role in the section that really addresses the kind of media and linguistic work that was done to rehabilitate the image of the hacker. And the Loft is a Boston/Cambridge, Massachusetts-based group that was interesting because they actually met in a loft in person, right? And so there were many other kind of hacker groups, but many of them were sort of internet-based. I mean, there were definitely some other exceptions that were face-to-face. But they were kind of very, very tight group of people who, as the kind of 90s wore on, they both, first of all, participated in full disclosure by publishing advisories around vulnerabilities. They also wrote cracking software like LoftCrack, which allowed you to kind of get access to Microsoft passwords really easily. They really pushed against Microsoft as well in terms of, you know, Microsoft's inability to even admit that they had bad security. But they were also very invested in professionalizing, you know, and professionalizing in a way, first of all, like they wanted to be a self-sustaining entity. Like even initially, it wasn't like they were trying to make like huge bucks. They were just like wanting to do their work and get paid for it. And it was remarkably hard actually to pull that off. It was not easy. And in order to do that, they knew that they had to, when they worked with the media, convey that they were the good guys, right? And they had a media strategy. They had a business strategy. And interestingly enough, they also did not want to lose ties with the hacker community. They knew what happened to ComSec, again, this first company that tried to get off the ground. And so even as they were moving towards the professional sphere, they didn't want to cut ties with the kind of hacker community. And you know, one of the reasons they kind of published information and talked to anyone was a way to kind of retain ties to the hacker underground. And eventually they settled on the term gray hats, which we detailed, like, when they came up with the term. It was actually one of these really remarkable, remarkably hard things to pin down. But gray hat was a kind of term that encapsulated their working philosophy, that they make the theoretical practical, that they're willing to talk to different sort of parties, that they aren't, you know, wholly captured by the corporate world. They're also not wholly part of the underground. And so they're just very, very important for, you know, that move from underground to above ground security researcher.
I have I've got a little bit of a tangent question. One of our viewers just brought something up. I think it's a good point to remember when we're having these conversations. This is all very America-centric, right? Mm-hmm. It's extremely USA-centric. This is USA hacking culture. I know this is outside of the realms of the report, but what do we know about how hacking developed and its culture developed in other parts of the world?
I'll jump in very briefly. I mean, okay. We did interview some people from the Hacker's Choice and Tezo as well. One of the people was also an editor of FRAC. ADM, which I'm going to butcher if I say, but it's a really important French hacker group that was just so respected for their ability to find vulnerabilities and write exploits, right? And certainly we felt like, okay, so little of this history has been written. We had much more access to the American side, so we told that story.
Right.
But there's an interesting kind of both parallel story in Europe and also one that diverges, right?
Right.
And the parallel story is that some of the ADM guys also went on to found really big, important companies as well, right? And so there is a parallel history. But I think also hacking wasn't quite as demonized. The threats weren't as quite as bad. That said, again, the French state infiltrated the French hacker underground as well. But I think also, you know, another difference with Europe is, again, while there's a few very, very big security firms in France, I mean, France is a leader when it comes to cybersecurity firms, right? You know, other parts like Germany, for example, you just, I think, didn't have quite as strong financial incentives in the 2000s. Whereas in the United States, I mean, the security industry was just like so lucrative as well, right? And that also shifted things quite a bit. And I think that story is slightly different as well in different parts of Europe.
Thank you for that, Leldings. I hope I didn't screw up your username. There's a really great, really great point. And I think it's given me an idea for another episode of Cyber that we'll do, where we try to track down hacker culture in other parts of the world and figure out what was going on there. But back to this. Okay, so this kind of brings us around to this term that really struck me. What is security by the spectacle?
So, yeah, I mean, this actually relates to the last question in an interesting way, because we basically noticed that one of the main mechanisms by which hackers were able to kind of legitimate themselves and eventually professionalize was by, you know, drawing not only attention to these kind of security issues on like niche mailing lists like BugTrack, but also, you know, launching them into like the mainstream attention, right? So when we use the term security by spectacle, we are thinking of like the Cult of the Dead Cow's creation of a hacking tool called Back Orifice, which was a play on Microsoft's remote administration tool called Back Office. And it was designed to allow, you know, remote administration, but not necessarily with the user's permission. And it was, you know, released with a lot of media kind of, stunts associated with it and so on. And so it was talked about in
that's what happens when you let people get bored in Lubbock. You know.
Yeah, I think the developer of Back Orifice, Sir Distic, Josh Bookbinder, was, I think he was living in San Francisco at the time, but he was definitely associating with the Grandmaster Rat, the Lubbock, Texas founder of CDC, Rate, I think. But basically we were... Like it seemed like this legitimation process owed so much to, you know, basically staging these confrontations, these moral confrontations between the hackers and the vendors like Microsoft in very, very public forums like, you know, like the New York Times. And so it's that ability to garner spectacle and then, as the CDC put it in one of their, morality alert press releases related to this to stage their, you know, or to put their actions against Microsoft and see who looks better in black. Right. I think variations on that logic played out all over the world for sure. I mean, in the European context, something we could call security by spectacle was used by the Chaos Computer Club as early as like the mid-1980s when they took money from a bank exchange, I believe, and then gave it back to demonstrate that they could do it, right? So that also, you know, like I would love to see, you know, see more examples of where that kind of logic or that kind of mechanism were used in different contexts to make the public or the government in different places realize that hackers could actually be, you know, expose things that were in the public interest, not necessarily to be employable, but to be, you know, civic minded technologists or whatever. Right.
Let me bring it into the present then, because I feel like this mirrors stories that I read every week on Motherboard, usually by Lorenzo or Joseph Cox, about what's going on in the crypto space right now. Constantly, the security issues with the blockchain and with cryptocurrency are being exposed. You know, I think Lorenzo broke another story today. The hacker said, you know, I'm willing to give it back if XYZ conditions are met. And, you know, obviously there are also rug pulls and, you know, crypto.com gets drained of $15 million and you get to watch live as it's laundered through the Ethereum blockchain. And they don't seem interested in giving it back, right? But that ethos lives on, right? We're still seeing it every day, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, with crypto in particular, I know the big DAO hack. I don't remember how long ago that was, but a lot of people credit that as like a security by spectacle kind of moment where it demonstrated in this very spectacular way some of the crucial insecurities of that technology. And I don't know if it's, you know, developers today trying to recuperate that moment to, you know, remain bullish or whatever, or if, but I mean, I think at that time, I remember following that closely and there was some signals that the person who did that hack actually did it as a, you know, proof of concept attack to generate change in how those technologies were developing.
No, I was just actually, one of my students is doing a project on Ethereum. So I was just reading her dissertation proposal. And it was so clear that it was staged. It was done to force a conversation. A conversation was forced. I mean, the community almost broke apart, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it remains as a vital procedure. And it has to, you know, because obviously security is much better today. Whether it is, you know, programmers who already have security in mind when they're building software, whether it's bug bounty programs, whether it's auditing, you know, there's structures in place in a way that there wasn't before.
Google's forcing everyone to do 2FA on their email accounts now.
Exactly. But whether it is the fact that there's not enough resources combined with the true complexity, it's a wicked problem, you know, you do need these outsiders to kind of push the issue and put it on the agenda, right? And again, it's hackers who tend to do this. It's not people who were trained in the academy. That's not in their ethos to go that route.
Mm-hmm. And this also gets to another super interesting dynamic, because, I mean, crypto is obviously extremely controversial. There are people who don't want it to exist whatsoever. But likewise, you know, there were people who didn't want Microsoft to improve its security and continue to be able to exert so much influence over the software market, right? And so actually, like, right after the period we cover in our report, you started to have a movement appear called AntiSec, which was, you know, also, you know, very diehard underground hackers who were seeing this kind of professionalizing trend as a threat to the hack, you know, the underground hacker community, but also as ultimately like a, you know, a recuperative kind of force that was, you know, bringing hackers back in line with the mainstream establishment and its politics. And so they argued against things like full disclosure on the grounds that they were helping to improve a security industry that ultimately benefited, you know, U.S. hegemony, or that was one of the logics, right? So it's also interesting that, like, security by spectacle also, you know, in relation to crypto or in relation to more conventional computer security, is ultimately like a force that, even as it is very antagonistic, it is designed to improve the thing itself and not to destroy it, right?
Right. It exists within the system itself and seeks ultimately to continue to prop it up, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Very well put.
And I think that is probably a pretty good place to close out before I want to talk to you about, for another hour, about more of the ideological underpinnings and what the current wars are. Let me ask you this as one to go out on. What does hacker culture look like in 2022? Where are we at?
Wow. I mean, it's, I think, one thing that is clear is that there's certain elements that are very established. Like, we have a security world, lots of hackers work in InfoSec, right? That's not going to go away. But I will say this, it's not so much the present, but, you know, in some ways it was as if the underground had died. You know, there wasn't that much of a scene except for some real diehards or people who were very quiet. And yet then in 2011, 12, 13, 14, you have Anonymous, the hacktivists, who are using some of the same tactics from the underground, but for hacktivism. And in fact, Jeremy Hammond, who was Central Anonymous, was partly inspired by the anti-sec movement, who went, you know, hardcore against the white hats and gray hats, right? And he didn't like their politics, because their politics was just about cultural autonomy, but he loved their direct action methods, right? And so him and then others kind of like reinvented underground hacking for a different purpose, for leaking and hacking and exposing corruption, right? And I like that example just because sometimes it's just really hard to predict what will emerge, you know, from these different worlds. But finally, again, I do think blockchain is a very interesting area just because there's so much activity, they're changing the economy, there's so many security implications, right? So that's a domain that I think is particularly important in the hacker world. But again, I think that there will be surprises, even as there's very kind of established areas in hackerdom that kind of interface with the establishment.
I think that's a great place to close out on. Gabriella Coleman and Matt, I'm going to screw your name up. Gertson. Yes.
You got
Matt
it.
Gertson. Sorry. The paper is Wearing Many Hats. You can read it online. It's at datasociety.net. The Rise of the Professional Security Hacker. If you liked the show, please, you know, like, subscribe, rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. If you are watching us live on Twitch and you came late, it will be up as a podcast tomorrow morning. And we will be back next week with another Cyber at 4 p.m. Eastern here on Twitch. And I'm going to let this music play us out. It's lovely, lovely music.
traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.